Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk Splits. And as you see from the title, this is an epic edition of Turned Out of Punk Splits. Today on the show, returning to the show, I should say, from the Melvins and Altamont and a plethora of other projects, the great Dale Crover, and from Bikini Kill and Girl Sperm and a bunch of other, like a plethora of other projects, Frumpies, et cetera, the great Toby Vail returns to the show. I would say two of the most influential drummers to ever emerge from the Pacific Northwest punk scene. You can debate me on that. I say it to them on the show. But I'm coming with facts on this thing because obviously Dale and the Melvins and their influence and Toby and Bikini Kill and her writing and Riot Girl and the influence that Toby's had. We're talking about two people that have shaped very different parts of punk, but they're ultimately from the exact same place and grew up together. And so, yeah, when Tristan, my brother and show producer, and I were kind of chatting about, you know, dream splits we can put together, this was right up at the very top. I'm excited for you to hear it. As I said, I'm just off tour with Fucked Up. Shout out to anyone who I met on the road and talked to me about this podcast. We are going on tour again. You can check out fuckedup.cc for more dates in the future. So my voice is a little shredded. This thing's a little later than I would have liked it to have come out. But, you know, it's the road. It's not very conducive for recording intros and outros to a podcast. But now you're hearing it. Better late than never, right? Toby is right now on tour with Bikini Kill. If you are listening to this when it came out over in, I think, New Zealand right now, New Zealand and Australia, about to return to these shores. When I say these shores, I mean North American shores, where Bikini Kill will be going on tour. You can find out much more information about all the upcoming tour dates for Bikini Kill at bikinikill.com, including a show in Toronto that I got tickets for. Oh my gosh, I'm very excited to see this thing. Finally gonna get to see Bikini Kill. And the Melvins are going to be kicking off a 40th anniversary tour, one of the most important rock and roll bands ever, and to this day, one of the greatest live experiences you can ever see. You can find out more information over on all the Melvins social media sites. Melvins.net has a bunch of tour dates. There also has a brand new Melvins record, and it's fantastic. Has there ever been a bad Melvins record? I don't think a bad one. Ones that I like less than others, but a bad one? Never. And this one certainly is not. Bad Mood Rising is out now. You can check it out wherever you listen to your music. I think a lot of the vinyl is sold out, but I'm sure there's a way to get some of the old records. There's probably a new pressing or something. They'll have it on the road. And as I said, you can find out more about those Melvins tour dates online. Toby is at Miss Toby Vail on Instagram, and Dale is at Dr. Crover, Dr. Crover. Maybe it's not Doc. Maybe his middle name starts with an R. I should check that out. But anyway, Dr. Crover on Instagram as well. And yeah, check out both these people. If you're not familiar with either of these people's work, there's a lot more punk out there for you to check out because, you know, these are huge. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. I think that's it. But before I let you go, I got to give a huge thank you to our sponsor, the great Cream Magazine, which is back, not just online, in physical form as well. That is Cream with two E's for you unfamiliar people with it. But you should be familiar with it because this is the place that punk rock got its first name in print. I think the great Lester Bangs, former editor of Cream Magazine, was the person that coined the use of punk in terms of music, talking about 60s punk garage rock bands. But you can check out yourself all, if I'm lying, or you can read all the stuff Lester Bangs wrote, because Cream has also digitized a whole archive of every issue they've ever done. Head over to cream.com to get access to this website, which with this archive, to see merch, and to also subscribe to the magazine. Because as I said, it is back in physical form. It's well over 100 pages of beautiful photographs and incredible writing. Unbelievable. The list of contributors is fantastic for this thing. Every issue so far has been well worthy of an addition to your library, and they will continue to put out great magazines. And for you, dear listeners of Turned Out of Punk, they are offering you a special 15% off your subscription or joining the fan club, which gives you access to it online and stuff. But we like physical formats here at Turned Out of Punk, so you probably want to subscribe to the magazine. Anyway, you get 15% off if you use the promo code, all one word, Turned Out of Punk. It says caps on here, so maybe put it in caps and subscribe and check this out. And thank you to Cream for supporting this podcast. I feel great synergy with synergy is such a terrible thing. I feel like a really strong connection with Cream Magazine, and I'm very stoked that they believed enough in this podcast to help me cover the costs of doing this thing. So thank you for that. Check out cream.com with two E's. You should know that. For more information, and subscribe to this thing. It's fantastic. Beautiful magazine. And I just got back from the UK where, you know, magazine culture is very much alive and well, and picking up magazines and reading them in the van. It's one of the great joys. Oh my gosh. All right. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Toby Vail and Dale Crover on Turned Out of Punk Splits.
Dale, Toby, Dale, welcome back to the show.
Hello.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Well, this episode is very exciting for my two younger children. My older child, unless I was talking to KSI, I don't think he would be that excited right now. But my younger two are very excited because my middle son has just started playing drums and is fans of both of your playing. And he's learning about drummers. And my youngest child has just out of nowhere become obsessed with the music from the 90s in the Pacific Northwest. And it's really weird having a 7-year-old want to ask me questions about different bands. And, you know, I've been trying to force music on my kids, the first two, for so long that I just kind of gave up with the third one. And yet here he is coming to it naturally. So they're going to be very excited about listening to this episode. Don't worry, I'll censor it for them.
See, that was your problem, is you tried to force it on them.
Oh, I passively forced it. Passively. Okay. You know, like I play, you know, like you do the same thing, I imagine. You just play your kids stuff that you enjoy. You don't try and make it their thing.
Sure. But I never expected them to like it. I always expected them to like horrible music. But my daughter actually likes some pretty good stuff. So I did something right, I guess.
I talked to the kids in the Linda Lindas the other day. Uh-huh. And finding out that they're like, not all of them, but three of them are like the children of like punk rockers, and we're going to shows.
Okay.
Very, very young. And it made me want to talk to them and see, what did you do that I did wrong? Because I don't think my kids are going to want to be in a band. I think I've scared them straight.
I don't know. No idea. I mean, there are certain things that she discovered on her own, like Nirvana. I mean, believe it or not, I wasn't playing a lot of Nirvana in the house. Yeah. You know, she knew that there was a connection, but didn't really know, and just kind of discovered that on her own.
That's kind of where it started with my youngest child, too. And it started with Smells Like Teen Spirit, and now it's Bleach. And it was just so weird because, like, I always wonder, like, you know, like Nirvana, but like bands like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelin, like, are these bands ostensibly better than their peers, or have we just been conditioned to think that this is some sort of like paradigm shift in music that happened and could have only happened given these sorts of people? So it's interesting to see young kids without any of the cultural baggage still gravitating towards certain things. Like the kids started loving the Beatles, and I like the Beatles, but I'm not like a Beatles obsessive, but yet they still naturally kind of gravitated towards that. And it's like, oh, I guess there is something to these bands.
Yeah. Well,
there's definitely something to the drummers. Like, think about it. John Bonham, Ringo, Charlie Watts. Like, I don't think those are normal drummers. I don't think those three people are. I think that they have something special. I mean, you could say it about, you know, any number of musicians, but just thinking from a drumming point of view, that music is pretty magical, I think.
Yeah, well, it's also, for sure.
It's crazy because, like, I think of you two as being two of the most influential drummers in punk rock, completely different styles, like completely different. And I never place you guys in the same space temporally, obviously being not from there. So to me, it's almost like different universes. And it wasn't until I think I saw the Melvins cover Rebel Girl in Nashville. And we were talking after the show and you're like, oh yeah, like, you know, we knew Toby, we knew all of them from like young kids and like we played with them, like we knew them. And it was just very eye-opening for me because it brings home the fact that the Pacific Northwest, in particular sort of Seattle and Aberdeen and Olympia and right down to Portland, it is like a really small scene ultimately, or like a very tight-knit scene, it seems like.
Small, but there was really a lot small. Going on.
Yeah, in the 80s, it was small. There was, nothing.
Very small.
It was like, it's kind of funny, like when you think about how many people from that tiny Olympia, early Olympia music scene, like went on to do other things. Like even just like people that were kind of on the fringe of it. Like I realized that the singer from Skies Cries Mary, or what is that band called? Sky Cries Mary. She was like one of the girls that went to the Tropicana, and I knew her because I copied her chemistry homework. And in high school, but like I didn't know she was a musician, and she changed her name. So then, like years later, I realized, oh wait, she was like one of those kids too. And then also, like the guy Rob Roth from Truly, he wasn't really a part of the Tropicana scene, but he like went to my high school, and like he was this mod kid that like he wore a trench coat and like he was into the Jam and stuff, and I saw him actually like when I went to go see the Who play Quadrophenia in like 1996, because I never, you know, saw it before, and we got in free somehow. And like the guy sitting in front of me, I was like, that's Rob Roth from ninth grade or whatever. And like, I think I was there with like William from the Foo Fighters or something. He's like, that's the guy from Truly. And I was like, that's just like this guy that like used to let me borrow Melody Makers or whatever, like in high school, because he had a subscription, or I don't know, NME or something like that. It was like really weird, like a lot, and because that's just weird. That's strange that all that stuff came out of one tiny little universe.
Right. Well, even the fact that there was more than one band from Aberdeen, which is even more isolated. Olympia was like the big city compared to Aberdeen. You know, there was nothing there.
It's fascinating when you look at why punk, hardcore, DIY culture took to certain places harder than it took to other places. Like population wise, like I don't know American geography that well, so I assume Chicago size wise is kind of close to Seattle, yet I think
it's bigger,
bigger, but yet there's more music that seems to come out of Seattle, because like there's like, you know, the early first wave punk scene. There's also that weird new wave scene with bands like Strider and D-Best and all that stuff. There's later on, there's all sorts of like doomy stuff. There's just like just such a plethora of styles coming out of it. And, you know, as you're saying, it's not bigger than Chicago, yet it seems like a lot more coming out of it.
I mean, it didn't really seem like that at the time. It seemed like nothing was happening. I mean, looking back on it, something was happening, but it didn't to me. It just seemed like, I don't know, there's like the U-Men, Seattle, what else? I don't know.
Well, that's kind of why we wanted to move to California too. We're just like, oh, I don't know. I mean, it was actually at the time really hard to even get gigs in Seattle. You know, there was very few places to play. And then once we moved away and came back, there was a lot more places to play, and it was, I don't know, it was better.
I think it's like I first heard it in that movie Hype, but I think it's become something that's almost like a cliche at this point, that the reason stuff developed in Seattle is because no one ever came there. But, you know, through talking to people, like bands came to Seattle, like, you know, like DOA, stuff from Vancouver. It seems like there was a lot of cross pollination. Certainly bands from California came up there. But was it a case of bands just like not coming through? Did you feel like you guys were isolated?
Well,
Go ahead, Toby.
No, you go ahead.
I think it was far for a lot of bands. I mean, there was, you know, between like San Francisco, even going to Portland, that's a long drive. There was nothing in between, really not any place to play, not at least not that long ago. So it was a trek for bands to come up there. But I think a lot of bands did make it there. But then there's bands like Flipper who always canceled. It never made it up there. You know, there was a lot of bands like that.
Imagine when you leave San Francisco as Flipper, you're like, yeah, this will be an easy drive. And then you hit weed and there's no drugs left. You're like, let's just go back.
Right. Yeah.
I know, like, Minor Threat never played
right
up here. Mm. And like, no, someone like recently was like, oh, like, we're like, there are a lot of DC hardcore bands playing in the Northwest. And that had the DC Olympia thing happen. I was like, no, DC hardcore bands didn't tour. Like, I mean, Minor Threat was like the exception and they didn't even make it here, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. Scream.
So, yeah. Scream did. Yeah. That's true. You're right. But not very many, you know?
No.
I guess it's like the later era of Discord stuff where the bands start getting out there. And that's when that kind of, I guess, thing kind of between the two cities happens, right?
Yeah. I mean,
this is hard to tour back then. You know, when we first went on tour, we only had a 7-inch out and it wasn't distributed well. So nobody knew who we were. And just going on tour, it was hard to do, hard to make any money doing it.
By the time the CZ record had come out, was it there already the intention that you were like, we have to get out of Seattle, or is that kind of after touring a little bit?
You mean to move away?
Or yeah, to move away.
Just
finding somewhere else to live, somewhere else to be based as a band.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that just kind of happened, but I mean, we probably would have moved to Seattle, or at least we would have easily have moved out of Aberdeen at some point, you know. Just the opportunity for us, you know, came about that we could move to San Francisco, and we liked it there, and it was someplace different. And like I was saying, Seattle, I mean, at the time there was a few places, but there wasn't that many, you know. There was the Vogue happening and maybe the Central, and that was kind of it, you know. When by the time we left, there's not really anything going on in Olympia. Tacoma had the Community World Theater, but it was kind of towards the end too, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, because so, Gesco was closed. Gesco closed and Recomuse hadn't opened yet, so we didn't have anything right at all when you guys left.
Right.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about that, Toby, because last time you talked about how important the Melvins were as like a band for you as a young person. What did it feel like when they do leave? Like, did it feel like,
oh yeah, we've probably talked about this before. I was just like,
yeah,
I remember this, like, I was just like in tears. Like, I don't know how to like compare, like what I can compare it to. Like, it's just like something I totally took for granted that would always be there. And then I just was like, it just felt like almost like when we had the earthquake and I realized that like, you can't ever count on anything. Like, nothing is permanent, you know, like a building could just be gone, or all of downtown Olympia could just be gone, or, you know, like 9/11 or something like that. I know this sounds ridiculous, but it's like one of those moments personally where I was like, oh yeah, like change is just like the only constant. Like, that's sure, kind of what made me realize, like, you can't really base your life or, you know, your sense of like who you are in relation to anything, really. It has to come from yourself.
It feels like the Melvins though had like a disproportionately important roles in lives of people that were around them early on. Like I guess like Black Flag does. Like, there's almost like, not as sinister, I guess, ultimately as the Black Flag cult, but there almost seems like there's a cult of the Melvins almost immediately with local kids like yourself, Toby, like going, like, you know, finding something in this band.
Yeah, I mean, there was like a small group of kids who were really into the Melvins, and it, you know, as the Melvins got better, which they got really, really good, you know, probably because you guys practiced so much. It just, you know, I mean, I'm guessing, like, you don't
get
that
to do
without practice. Yeah, like, you just got really good. You were like way better than all the other bands, and then, you know, it just seemed really exciting. Like, that, yeah, nothing was happening. Like, after the Tropic,
yeah,
nothing was happening. So they'd be like, oh, the Melvins are playing Tacoma in this weird warehouse, like industrial noise or something. And they'd be like, okay, well, everyone's going to drive there. And then it's like, oh, the Melvins are playing Gorilla Gardens. Okay, everyone's going to drive there. Okay, like, Melvins are playing Community World Theater, you know, or Melvins are playing Crescent Ballroom. It would just be like something to do because there really was nothing going on here. And then, like, anytime, like, we would get a venue, like, all the Melvins shows would be like really, really fun.
Were, yeah, were like the U-Men like a 21 and over type band more then? Like, were the Melvins like much more like an all ages kind of band?
Well, the Seattle Teen Dance Hall Ordinance or whatever like passed in like 1985 or something. So then kids like under 21 couldn't get into shows anymore. So, you know, unless they were like really big shows, like in theaters, I think they could get around it. Like, you know, like the more theater would have like those big, huge grunge shows that were all ages in the early 90s, and they got around it that way. I think like if you could afford the insurance, you could get around it, but nobody really could. So that's when like a lot of kids started going to Tacoma to see shows, or like Olympia when there was like a place, but it wasn't, you know, there really wasn't that much solid here either.
Or borrowing their older friends' ID so they could get into shows at the Central.
Yeah. I mean, you'll remember, I looked like I was 12 even when I was like 20. So there was no way that was going to ever work.
Yeah.
It's very interesting how it's almost like, you know, once again, completely different bands, but it's similar to like the Bad Brains in DC. It feels like they leave and that's kind of the start of everything kind of happening for the next generation of kids in DC hardcore. And it's almost like the Melvins kind of have a similar effect, you know, once again, looking at this distanced from it.
I can see that. After you guys left, it's like when I got, or after the Tropicana closed is one thing, and then after the Melvins left, it's like that, you know, there's nothing to do except for just like focus on your own band. Like,
sure.
You know, like, yeah, so that makes sense to me. But also, you know, Bikini Kill, we had to leave too. Like, we had to go to DC because we were trying to make it as an actual band that doesn't have to get jobs, you know? So, yeah. Like, there's no way you can do that here. Like, even now, like, you just have to. I remember, like, after I went on my first couple of national tours, I was like, man, if you lived in Ohio, you could just, could be based here and you could play anywhere. Like, because there's so many colleges, and, you know, you used to be able to make a lot of money playing colleges. And there's so many colleges just in Ohio, you could maybe tour Ohio forever. But also, like, you could get to the East Coast, you could get to Chicago, you could get to the South, you know, you could get to Minneapolis. Like, it just seemed like really clear that, like, Olympia was, like, probably the worst place to be in a band if you were trying to, like, do anything serious with it in terms of just, like, anyone paying attention or, like, being able to, like, you know, play shows when you're not on tour or whatever. Or like you could do those like little mini tours, which is what we did when we lived in DC. We did a bunch of them.
Yeah, shorter drives too, I'm sure.
For sure.
Yeah. A lot more places to play, for sure. But you guys didn't move to Seattle like everybody else?
No, we were anti-Seattle at the time. And, you know, I don't know if that was just like an antagonistic thing. When I was a little kid, I loved Seattle, but in the 90s, I hated it. So I don't know. I think it's a beautiful city, but it's full of rich people now. No one can afford to live there.
Right. Oh, it's kind of every major city now.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's really like, you know, I've been doing interviews for the new record we did, and I'm just talking to people, and I'm like, yeah, there's no spaces. Like, I don't know how a band would start in Toronto now. Like, forget about trying to find somewhere to live, but like, where would you practice? Where'd you store gear?
Yeah.
The big practice space near my house that we all practiced at, like every band in Toronto practiced their Mets and everyone, just got bought by a church, which is the irony, given how many times we had to help falling apart churches by doing shows in the basement or, you know, using church places as show spaces. And now here they are taking away our practice spaces. This vengeful God people talk about.
Yeah. Fortunately, I've been able to practice in my garage. So it's been a while, but I got a new place and I got a drum set up out there and some amps and some guitars. I'm not cranking loud, but it's pretty fun.
We got a little electronic drum set in the basement now because my son has it. And I complained about the volume the other day and realized, oh my God, what have I done to myself?
Wow.
But Toby, you said you thought you were at Dale's first show, or Dale, you said Toby was at the first show or something. Toby, you mentioned it last time, right? The first.
Oh yeah. It came up when we were talking about the Tropicana. And then like, I remembered like Dale, when like you guys, I don't know, you guys had a podcast. I don't know if that ever aired and we're on it. And then like, you're like, we're talking about, cause I was talking about how, like, I never was into metal and like growing up or whatever. Like I was got into punk through like being more into new wave music. And then, so I was kind of like, didn't really get like some of the, or like kind of metal influenced punk at first. And then I was just like, I saw like all your early shows, but I didn't think I was really into it until like you guys opened for DOA, and then you guys that were like, that was Dale's first show.
That was
like,
my first show. Yeah.
I think it was the drummer.
See, it was the drummer that changed your mind.
It's always the drummer. As Toby said, it comes down to these amazing drummers.
I don't know. Yeah. And I don't remember anything particular about that show. I do remember, like, you know, like when you first like get into weird music when you're a kid and you like, you really want to like it. So you just keep listening to it over and over and over again. And you're like, it doesn't sound like music. You know what I mean? You're like, what is it? Like, what is it that I'm supposed to be like hearing? Or, you know, it's like, you're just listening to the notes and you can't even get it in your head yet. Like, that's kind of how it was for me at first, but then I got it.
Yeah.
You joined. Yeah.
I was thinking about this a couple months ago. Are the Melvins the first post-hardcore band? Like the band that's first fed up with it and already like, let's figure out something else. And I guess Black Flag's already kind of doing it too, but you guys are really early, before Dinosaur Jr.
I don't know. Like, that term post-hardcore now has that meaning. That means like, yeah, like the way you're using it. But like, I remember the way people used to use it in the 90s was like those bands with Big Shorts that were kind of like doing this new kind of hardcore. You know, the moshy kind of, like, they had the like extra large shirt and the like giant shorts, and they would say like fuck racism on their shirt, and then like they'd have a singer that would do like Rage Against the Machine kind of stuff. That's what people used to say post-hardcore was, just that kind of hardcore, I guess, like sort of metal influence hardcore, like, I don't know, maybe like Integrity or something, you know. But now they mean the other meaning, like the My War Black Flag kind of thing could be one example, or like, yeah, like alternative rock, I guess.
I remember reading in a Maximum Rock and Roll column, someone saying that Black Flag was the first emo band, and laying out a well thought out article column about how Black Flag was the first emo band. Once again, this is using the 90s definition of emo, hot topic.
Yeah.
Would
that
make Henry the first emo singer then? It'd be Henry, right?
I think it would be, yeah. Like, and I think he lives up to that, right?
Wow.
Like, in terms of the kind of like archetype of that thing, you know. But it's interesting how
that's funny.
Well, I was thinking about this with Power Violence, and it's these terms that were like thrown around in zines, and just used to refer to like particular bands operating in a particular time in a particular space, that eventually become just genres to people. Mm-hmm. And it's so, you know, it's just so interesting to kind of watch these sort of evolutions. Obviously Riot Girl is a huge one for that to happen. Like, people talk about bands like Riot Girl bands, and it's like, none of the bands that were associated with it had a particular sound. So like, what is the sound?
Yeah, well, I mean, and it was almost like with Straight Edge or something, where it's like, we didn't call ourselves a Riot Girl band. Riot Girl was like something that happened at the same time as us, with some of us being involved, but that it wasn't a style of music. But I think there were some bands that maybe did call themselves that, like maybe Bratmobile and Heavens to Betsy. Mm-hmm. I'm not totally sure though. But, you know, then like you'd play with a band in like Omaha, Nebraska, and be like, they would call themselves Riot Girl. But then, I don't know, kind of sound like a little bit like Pete Happening influenced, maybe. They didn't usually sound like Bikini Kill.
It's interesting how quickly this stuff spread too. You know, just go back to what you're saying, I guess.
No, it's okay.
But I think what you're saying is like very true. Like, Bikini Kill is, and not to say that Heaven to Betsy and, you know, like, isn't a punk band, because they're obviously a punk band, but like Bikini Kill is like a hardcore band. Like, it's like got this like rawness and edge to it that always screamed like hardcore to me.
I mean, yes and no. I've been like going through all of my diaries because I'm trying to make a timeline to make some kind of like writing, like a book or something. And like, and also because I'm working on this Olympia music history archiving project with the city. And so I've been trying to do a timeline, and I'm like, God, all the stuff I say in here is so psycho. But like, yeah, there's this one entry where it's like, I don't hate hardcore anymore, or something like that. I don't hate hardcore, or there's something else. It's really funny. And I was like, yeah, when Bikini Kill first started, I was like, I hated hardcore. Like, I was like, I'd swung back totally against it. And then, yeah, by like the mid 90s, I was into it again. It's kind of weird.
What kind of bands were you listening to back then?
In the mid 90s?
Yeah. Well, what bands were influencing you guys?
Oh, I mean, well, I guess maybe you could say hardcore bands, like, because then I listened to Kathy's interview that she did for that project, and she's like, Toby came over to my house And she's just like, I knew like an E chord and an A chord on guitar. And Toby came over to my house with like the Faith Void record and Minor Threat. And I was like, this is like Rachmaninoff. Like, there's no way I can play this. And then I guess I brought her like the first Ramones album, and she picked up, she like borrowed my bass, and then she was able to like figure that out. Cause she's a, you know, she's a, she's very musical. She'd play piano and stuff, but she didn't know how to play guitar or bass. But so I'm like, oh, I guess those were like DC hardcore was definitely, we were listening to it, but I don't remember it that way, but she does. Yeah. I think we were listening to I don't know. This is just going to sound like I'm not making any sense, because we were definitely listening to like the Dicks and the Germs, like me and Billy.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hear the Germs in it. I definitely hear that kind of like the space you kind of give the words at times, and kind of like the, I don't know, I hear that Germs influence.
And then like all four of us, like probably the main band that we were into is Babes in Toyland, because they toured a lot in 1989.
Yeah.
And like the Go Team played with them in Duluth, Minnesota, and then I think they played in Olympia like maybe three times that year, and they were just phenomenal when they had Michelle playing bass. And
yeah,
it was, they were playing these tiny shows with shitty PAs, and they just were like monsters. And Billy was really influenced by Kat's guitar playing, actually. Like,
oh cool.
Yeah, like he just loves her. And then I think, yeah, we were all really into that.
We met them probably around that time, about 89. We played with them on Easter Sunday at Humboldt at the college there, to probably nobody. And then we befriended them right away. We had the same booking agent, and there's some connections there. And I remember that we rode with them back from Humboldt to our house, which was like about 6 hours, and they stayed at our house for a while, and we became friends. Still friends with Lori. See her all the time.
We played with them, I guess, a couple years ago when they did that reunion thing in Primavera, yeah. And they were fucking awesome. Like,
yeah,
they were, yeah, it was super heavy still. Like, I'd seen them years ago, and then to see them this, you know, like, it's like, I wonder what it's going to be like. And it was amazing.
I don't even know if it's like a past tense thing. I don't think that there had ever been like a band full of women playing music at that level, playing rock and roll that fiercely. And that like, just like they had that same Melvins thing where it's just like, you feel like they're channeling something, like they're like almost like a Greg Sage, like, I don't know, like something that is very rare that you see in a great band where it's like, they're just like tapping into something. They're like,
yeah,
transmitting energy like through music in this, on this level that not everyone can do. Like Black Flag can do that, but like I'd never seen women do that before, and it's super rare in a band, you know.
Well, I wanted to ask you, what about ASF, like I think it's like Anti-Scrinity Faction, the pre-Tribe Eight band.
Yeah,
did they ever come through, or was there any, like, I know, I guess it's pretty far, they were Colorado, I think, right? Boulder. I think they're Boulder.
Boulder. No, they were in the 80s. So I don't think they toured, but we had their demo tape at Chaos, or maybe it was a 7-inch or something. And I have their album on cassette. I still have it. They were like a big influence on my first band, Doris, because I think that they were like, we're an all-girl skate band. And I was like, we are too. But it was like, I don't even know what that means. Like, it's not even really a style of music. but later, yeah, I met Leslie, who was in that band. And actually, Donna Dresch, her partner, was the first drummer for that band. And they met completely in a way that had nothing to do with music. And so that was kind of funny. Like, her current partner. And then, okay, so Leslie was going out with this person, Stacy Quijas, and in the early 90s, and Stacy Quijas was our roadie for a while. So we felt like really connected to that scene in this weird way.
I get, and you're both on a comp together too, right? I think.
Tribe 8. Oh, Tribe 8, yeah. There's the Dyke in the Pit. Yeah. Like that weird 7-inch comp.
Yeah, there's a they're like a band. Tribate too. Like I went back and listened to Tribate recently, and I'm like, oh my god, this band is like a band that, you know, I remember listening to back then, but I guess it was over my head. And you know, it's it, go on, sorry.
They were doing crazy stuff on stage.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think they played Toronto, but I must have seen a video maybe at Who's Emma or like one of the anarchist record store type thing. And I remember the video just blowing my mind as like a 15-year-old kid, like, holy shit, this band looks insane on stage.
Yeah, I think Frightway was a big influence on Bikini Kill for sure. Frightway and Babes in Toyland. Yeah.
They're a band that I only started appreciating through doing this podcast, and I think Dale, you brought them up the first time the Melvins were on the show, and then Margaret Cho brought them up, and then Toby, you brought them up. They're a hugely influential band that no one talks about. Like, they never get brought.
Yeah.
Also, Paul Leary from the Butthole Surfers brought them up too when he was on the show. So they definitely are a band that seems like they impacted everyone that was kind of like making moves and making waves at that point.
Sure, and the Red Cross guys were really into him as well.
Mm-hmm.
Produced one of their records. And then Rebecca is actually from Montreal.
Oh, the Canadian connection too.
There you go, yeah.
Like, were there any, where were the bands that came over? I know the Tree People would come over and play, but were there like local scenes? I guess you guys are already gone by this point, Dale, but Toby, were there like local scenes nearby that there were kind of part of things, or like other than Portland and stuff, and I guess Eugene?
Yeah, there was like Ellensburg didn't really have a scene, but the Screaming Cheese would play, and then the people who they were friends with started having bands, like and they would play over here. Like, I can't think of what the bands were called.
Solomon Grundy.
Yeah, that was like Van Conner's band, right? But there was another band called Corn Dump. They were kind of like teenagers. I think the Connor's little brother, Pat, was in that band. They played here. The first time I saw them, they were called Blearg, which I don't know why. And they threw pencils out in the audience that said Blearg.
Well, I think you're on this, Dale. Do you know the Blearg comps that Slapham put out in the 90s?
Oh, yeah.
Like the 7-inch with like 100 bands on them?
Right.
I don't know.
You don't know these? Oh, I think I've got it right here. I could probably reach it over and grab it. I won't make you guys sit there and wait while I go through the records. But yeah, there's like a bunch of 7-inches that Slapham Records put out. There's a Blearg comp, Son of Blearg, and then something else. And I always wondered where that word came from too, but I guess it's like it was in the zeitgeist.
Know.
Corn dumps.
I don't know. Corn dump, formerly Blearg. Yeah. And Anna Cortis had some bands. Brett Lunsford from Beat Happening was from there. So some of those bands would play, like the Pounding Surfs that was in the Kate scene. And then there was like a Eugene bands that would play in Olympia, like Some Velvet Sidewalk and Snake Pit.
Oh, yeah. And then Tacoma, there was Noxious Fumes and what's their names?
Girl Trouble.
Girl Trouble. Thank you.
Yeah, Girl Trouble, Noxious Fumes. And there was a bunch of other bands like He Sluts and Vampire Circus.
I just saw the guitar player from He Sluts not that long ago. He came to one of our shows in Sacramento. Ted. Remember Ted?
I don't remember. I remember the singer.
That's him.
Sluts. Maybe I have it mixed up. The guy from He Sluts?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm remembering the bass player.
Yeah, that was the black guy, green leather jacket. I can't think of his name.
Scott Burrows, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
right,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
There was like a connection with Girl Trouble and Shadowy Men, right? Like, I know Don Pyle's done some stuff with Girl Trouble over the years, and I don't think they ever played here, so it must have been when Shadowy Men were kind of coming out doing shows out west.
I know that Bon has talked about playing with Shadowy Men, but I don't know where they met. Shadowy Men for a Shadowy Planet played Olympia a few times. They played IPU, I think, and they played Reco Muse at this terrible show that I put on that was kind of a disaster, but it ended up being fine.
Yeah. And those are the shows that you always remember, right? Like, I find now all the good shows kind of blend in, but it's the shows where you're like, oh, that was a really bad show that you always go back to, and it's the funny stories. They're hard to get through, but they become great memories eventually.
Yeah.
Well, do you guys ever have this where you think you played the worst show ever, and then people come up and go, that was the best show I've ever seen you guys do?
Well, what would a bad Melvin show look like? Like, because I find...
Oh, I don't know. Just, I mean... Whatever, just like, you know, screwing up, you know, all the time, or just like not having an off show or whatever.
I just couldn't imagine, like, you guys are just so locked in, you know, and it's amazing to watch, but I just can't, like, fucked up. It just feels like we're holding it together with duct tape and broken promises, and it's going to fall apart. And it has fallen apart many times on stage where, you know, all of a sudden I stop believing I can fly and I crash down to earth and I bring the whole band down with me. But, you know, I just can't imagine that happening with you guys.
Yeah, it's something to keep in mind. I always try to be like, okay, like that show seemed really bad to me, but I have no idea how it came across to someone in the audience. And vice versa, you know, like I think the only, like most of the shows I could think of that were Melvin's shows that were like not as good as the other ones were just like the sound was bad. You know, like the guitar sounded like it was in the wrong tone through the PA or something, or, you know, like.
Yeah, that kind of stuff
happens. Echo on the drums for no reason or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. At the same time, we've played shows where it's like, oh, wow, that felt really good. And then people are just kind of like, eh. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you never know.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That's just being a band in Toronto, you know, you get the Toronto shrug, you know, it's like, yeah. It's a music industry town. So everyone's competition.
Right.
Which I guess wasn't a factor as much for yourselves until later on. Right. Like there must've been was there competition between bands, or was like everyone kind of pulling in the same direction? Like, which is something I find definitely when you talk to people from like North Carolina or from Atlanta or from or Athens, I should say, like a scene where there wasn't necessarily commercial pressure. So bands seem to kind of operate better or coexist better.
Oh, well, yeah. In the 80s, people totally supported each other way more than in the 90s, I think.
Right, but there was competitions because everybody always wanted to play the cool shows.
Oh, yeah, you know? Like everyone was mad that Meet Happening got to open for Black Flag because everyone thought that their own band should be
able to. Oh, right.
Yeah, I do remember that. People were getting mad a lot at Calvin because they'd be like, why is Meet Happening playing that show? And I'm just like, he probably put the show on.
Yeah, exactly.
Dale, what drove you guys to want to move to LA? Were there like bands that you felt, because I know when you were on before you talked about, I guess it's the same DOA show that Toby brought up, where there was that kind of beef with DOA, and I think you both you and Buzz said you guys didn't really fit in with a lot of the bands that were coming through and going. Like, what was it about Los Angeles that you guys thought was going to have something, or San Francisco?
Yeah, we first moved to San Francisco, and like I said, it was just kind of like an opportunity that presented itself. We had signed with a label from there, and we recorded our first record there, and met this band Clown Alley, who were also in, sort of involved in the label, and their bass player became our future ex-bass player, and Buzz's future ex-girlfriend. And I don't know, it was just, like I said, you know, I mean, it was, there wasn't much going on in Seattle, and it was just kind of like going someplace and having a fresh start, which was pretty much what happened. I mean, we pretty, you know, we started over.
Yeah.
You know, someplace new where nobody knew who we were, you know, and we did have, you know, even though our following wasn't huge, we did leave that behind to go do something new. Other than that, you know, other than it was someplace that we liked, you know, with Seattle was, you know, I guess we kind of felt like there just wasn't much going on.
Yeah, I guess as you're saying, it's kind of like Alchemy Records being there, but there's also like the farm. There's like a lot of places that are popping up, venues, and it does feel like the opposite that's happening in Seattle, where there's nowhere to play. There must have been tons of stuff going on, like every night. You know, I remember going to San Francisco the first time in the 90s and just being like, oh my God, this is like the punk rock capital of the world.
It was good. I mean, it was hard for us to get shows at first, but, you know, eventually we did. And yeah, we left right when everything was exploding. But then we'd go back up there and play shows, and it seemed like nobody really knew that we left. There's still people that think we live there still, so, you know. And it was better. I mean, we could go back and, I mean, you know, when we left, we were making like, you know, $100, $150. You know, it wasn't there. It didn't feel like we were leaving much, you know.
Did you guys get subsumed in or play at all with the speed metal stuff and the thrash stuff that's kind of popping up around that same time in San Francisco and the Bay Area?
Show wise, no. But I mean, I remember we played shows in Tacoma that would be like us and DRI, or I know I told you about shows with Poison Idea. Some of those shows were just insane. Toby, did you ever see Poison Idea play at the Crescent Ballroom?
I did, and I have no memory of it, which is like completely baffling to me.
Well, how about, you must remember like Jerry A used to blow those big fireballs, and they would.
I have no memory of ever seeing Poison Idea, and I thought that they only played over 21 shows, and I was like looking through my flyers, which are like mostly shows I went to, and they're all over like a ton of shows, and then I was just like, maybe I just didn't care because I thought they were just like drunk, weird adults. You know?
Yeah.
Well, and I was just like, oh, the weird really drunk good. Adults are playing. I'm not going to watch this band.
Well, like, they were really good. Like, they were like,
so, I mean, I know they're good, but I don't remember ever seeing them.
Yeah. Well,
there was that one summer, like in 87, where there was a ton of really good shows at the Crescent Ballroom. I don't know if you ever.
Yeah. Like the Beyond Possession one and the Melvin. Yeah. I don't know. There was like a couple different ones. I always get the two confused. One is like False Liberty, The Accused, Melvin's. I don't know which one is which, but Poison Idea were definitely on one of them.
Yeah.
The most mind-blowing thing that Toby told me last time, Dale, is that Kathleen Hanna roadied or went on tour, I should say, with Poison Idea.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, then after I brought that up with her again, she goes, well, not really. I didn't really go on tour with them. I like went on tour with them in Fits of Depression. I went on tour with Fits of Depression and around the Northwest, and I took pictures of them. But like to us, that was like a tour. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, sure.
Like it was for Fits of Depression. It was a tour.
I tell people all the time that I tour with the Melvins, even though the reality is I was on a giant festival tour in Australia. But as far as I'm concerned, it was a Melvins tour.
Yeah.
Sure.
Oh, wait, Dale, I did want to ask you a question, though. So, like, I was just saying, like, I don't remember any, I didn't know anything about metal. So, like, I don't remember any of that. But, like, okay, so, like, Metal Church are from Aberdeen, right?
They are, sort of.
Did you guys know about them at the time?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the one of the guys that was in the band lived a block away from me. And when I was first getting into music, like I was really into Kiss. And I knew who he was. And one day I saw him and he had long hair. And I started talking to him. He's like, oh, hey, I have a Les Paul and a Marshall Houseback. And so I went over to his house, and he's the guy that pretty much convinced me to start playing drums.
Oh, cool.
So
yeah, I was wondering if there's a connection there. Like somebody texted me a photo of like Metal Church playing in Olympia at some venue I don't remember and was asking me about it. I was like, I have no knowledge of this band. I'll have to talk to someone who might know. Like, so they must have played Olympia. They played Olympia. I don't
probably
know.
Yeah, I mean, but they're originally from San Francisco, and like the only original guy is Kurt Vanderhoof, who was from Aberdeen. Okay. He also, if you know who he is, he was Blabo and the Lude.
Oh, okay. So I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So probably that's probably the first punk band I ever heard was probably the Lude. Now to think about it, because he was from there. I think he moved to San Francisco with the Lude and then joined like formed Metal Church. And then that version of the band broke up. He moved back to Aberdeen and reformed the band with a bunch of guys from there, including the guy that convinced me to play drums.
The other thing I wanted to know was, like, what about the time that the Ramones played in Aberdeen? Because Calvin told me he went to that show.
He did? Wow. Yeah, you know, I think I've been looking for his book. I should just order it online. But have you read that Monty Melnick book?
No.
About the Ramones? Oh, that's supposed to be really good.
I haven't read it.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable stories in that. Like Ed Stasium tells a story about Elton John showing up at the live recording of the record with a full SS BDSM outfit on
and
pulling out like a weird Iron Eagle like necklace and it being full of cocaine and the two of them just doing cocaine all night backstage.
Wow. I think, you know, there might even be audio of that gig that the Ramones playing in Aberdeen, but I think that he talks about it. I think Monty Melnick talks about it in his book. But anyway, the other thing I know about it is that it was supposed to be at this theater over in Hoquiam called the 7th Street Theater, maybe. And only two people bought tickets for the show. And one of the guys was Kurt Vanderhoof, Blabo from the Lude and Metal Church, and some other guy, some friend of his. They were underage and couldn't go. It got moved to this place called The Rocker.
That's awesome.
Played, I mean, when was it?
It must have been like 77, 78, probably something like that. You know, I think those guys played everywhere.
I wonder if Calvin was even 21. Like, I don't know. I'll have to ask him about it next time I see him because I just remember him telling me about that in the 80s.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that band NME at all? Like the letter N, M, E? They were like
I think that I saw them at Bumper Shoot, which is maybe not true, but I think that maybe it is true. I don't know. Yeah, my dad had the single, and I think that we saw them at Bumper Shoot, but I'm not sure. That's like this festival in Seattle that used to be really cheap.
I think they talk about that. That's where the U-Men play, and they light the whole lake on fire?
Probably. It's like you would buy one ticket, and then you could get into anything for the whole day, and it was crazy.
Yeah, the first time I went to Bumper Shoot was the same day I went to my very first punk rock show.
What? Who did you see at Bumper Shoot?
Spinal Tap.
Oh, wow.
It was their very last show. And it was like kind of the first time. It was the first time I went to a show with the Melvins, you know. But that day was pretty weird. I remember like we went to the show. I met Ben Shepherd, who was hanging out with those guys. He was hanging out with Buzz and Matt in Aberdeen. We went to that show together. And then at night we went over, I can't remember where it was. I want to say it might've been like the Mercer Arts Center, someplace like that. It was like three flights up. And I remember like the first punk rock show I saw, besides seeing the Melvins before, was, it was the Accused, the FUs and some other band. And I also remember meeting Mark Arm that night. So it was kind of like, that one day was pretty weird.
I think I might have that flyer. I'll look for it.
Yeah. There's a third band. I can't remember who it is.
That's wild that the FUs made it out to Seattle on tour.
Yeah. Yeah. From Boston. Yeah.
The FUs are on a Tropicana flyer, and I've asked a bunch of people if they actually played, and everyone has said, not that I remember, and I don't remember it either. So I think they canceled that show.
Probably would have been right around that time. for sure.
Someone could have got arrested.
Yeah. Or it could have got canceled.
May not have even confirmed the show. You know how like people are on flyers and they don't even know that they were supposed to play back then?
Yeah.
We didn't agree to play that show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then people are mad at you years later. And you're like, what do you mean we didn't show up? Like, there's no way. We weren't even on tour then. How did we get on this flyer?
Especially if they bought the poster on eBay for like a lot of money. There's like some Bellingham show. I'm like, we didn't even play that show. And everyone's right. Like, you're just making the value of the poster go down. I'm like, sorry.
That's actually in that movie Hype is the first time I ever heard someone talk about a punk flyer being worth money. There's that scene where the guy from CZ Records
is
cutting up stuff. And right. He's like throwing out these numbers for what these flyers are worth. And that was the first time I ever thought about that. But now we're in an era where, yeah, flyers are like a legit currency now.
Yeah, he's going to feel pretty bad about that now.
it's like with Misfits singles. I know a friend of mine who sold her entire Misfits collection in the 90s. And she was like, well, there's no way they're going to be worth more than this ever.
Oops.
But it also seems like in Seattle, the metal and the punk scene are like this double helix that sometimes converge and then sometimes seem really far apart. You know, like obviously what you're talking about with Metal Church, Dale, not being in Seattle, but I mean like sort of general area. But then you hear about that famous sort of Guns N' Roses show where there's the metal show going on and there's like the Fastbacks, I think, playing Fastbacks are playing the Guns N' Roses. Anyway, there's like two shows going on in the same place. And it was like completely separate scenes going to the two different shows.
Yeah, it was. I think it was Raw Power.
Whoa.
Raw Power
and Guns and Raw Power, and then Fastbacks and Guns N' Roses, right?
That's what it was. I think that's what it was. Yeah.
Those two shows don't even seem like they would be that different necessarily, like as far as the audience goes.
Yeah, that's true. But it was always it was, you know, Gorilla Gardens and Omni Room or whatever. So there was always like metal show in one room, punk show in the other. So, Kurt, and that was for whatever reason, the metal show.
I did a episode with Kurt and Duff like this, but they were in character the whole time. So I couldn't ask them about that show. They have like a concept record that they did together.
And So
they came on the show, but they would only do it in character the whole time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I was at that show or not. I mean, obviously, Dale, you were.
I was.
Did you watch Guns N' Roses?
I remember like being in the projection room was the dressing room, and so you could see out either side. I remember watching it for a little bit, but I don't know. I don't remember much of it at all.
But was that the case? Like, was there sort of like ebbs and flows in how close these two scenes were, Toby? Like the metal and the punk scene? Or did you always feel like metal was kind of a completely different bag?
I don't remember going to see any metal shows in the Gorilla Gardens. I just remember going to see the Melvins or like Danger Mouse, who are from Olympia, or, you know, like a touring band like 7 Seconds or Husker Du or something like that.
Yeah. But there's rock stuff. Like you're saying Screaming Trees, like that crosses over. And it seems like in other places that sonic wouldn't necessarily jive with the Raw Power sonic or even the Melvins kind of sonic.
Well, I mean, there was like Soundgarden playing, and those weren't metal shows or Malfunction. I mean,
Malfunction was kind of Spinal Tap-ish, but really
sort of.
Also just like a really good band, though. Like this, they had songs. I mean, you know, they had songs that were catchy. Like it wasn't just, I don't know.
But they were like, I mean, they weren't like.
Soundgarden all seemed kind of new wave at first.
yeah, maybe so. But then also, but I could tell that they had a Zeppelin influence in them right away.
Yeah.
You know, just
but like a weird, stuff, like, I don't know. Did they have chorus on the guitar? I just remember them seeming a little bit new wave at first.
Chorus?
Yeah.
Maybe. Oh, totally. Like, yeah. Like, I think that they were into like Killing Joke.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Killing Joke and Zeppelin.
It's interesting when Nate from like Foo Fighters, but back then I guess Brotherhood and Diddley Squat was on. He was talking about how much he just hated that Led Zeppelin influence that permeated some bands and how there's a lot of legendary bands that he was just like, I just completely dismissed it as being influenced by Led Zeppelin. Like it seems like there was maybe a generational break or maybe it's just that particular scene that sort of was reacting to the stuff that was getting popular around the time that their stuff was also, I guess, getting going.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe it was just like rebelling against like big 70s rock or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I actually hated anything after Led Zeppelin 4 for whatever reason. I liked the first four records and I thought everything else was just like annoying KZOK classic rock kind of shit. And everything else I thought was just like perfect sounding music. But I do remember like when I first heard it, I didn't like it at all. Like I had to get into kind of like heavier stuff and probably start drumming too.
What about Kiss? Were you a fan of Kiss at all?
Yeah, I loved Kiss, but I think we maybe talked about this before. Like I was such a little kid. I thought that they were like a cartoon. Like I didn't know that they weren't. I thought they were like Josie and the Pussycats or something. Yeah. You know, yeah, like I didn't really understand. Like, cause you'd look at the cover. I mean, I was really little and I didn't have older brothers and sisters. And it was just like my babysitter had the records, you know, They didn't look like humans. Yeah. I don't know. It was kind of like Croft. It's like Sid and Marty Croft.
Oh yeah, totally.
It was like Saturday morning cartoons. But yeah, I thought they were really scary and really good.
A Sid and Marty Croft Kiss special should have happened. That would have been amazing.
They did the Paul Lynn Halloween special, and then they also did, there's the Hanna-Barbera cartoon, like Kiss Meets the Phantom. It's not a cartoon, but it's exactly like an episode of Scooby-Doo.
Oh, yeah.
There's also the Kiss really Meets the Phantom in that movie, right?
That's, like it's like, yeah, that's what she's talking about, yeah. I think.
The live action, because I was recently watching like a newer Scooby-Doo thing with my kids, and they had Kiss on it.
Oh, right.
Oh, okay. Like, yeah,
it would be like having like, you know, someone from the jazz era on Scooby-Doo when I was a kid, but it's very interesting to hear.
Well, I would have preferred Kiss had their own Saturday morning variety show, but instead it was the Bay City Rollers.
Yeah.
But I remember like, you know, watching that just because it was guys playing music, and even watching how to like, oh, you play the drums like this. Okay. So that, you know, watching that early on.
I was reading an interview with Malcolm McLaren recently, and he was talking about how in this interview, McLaren, but talking about how he kind of like envisioned the Sex Pistols to being the Rolling Stones to the Bay City Rollers Beatles. And it's just, I can't imagine those two bands operating in the same space at all.
Yeah, that's funny. I think I read that interview too. I mean, they were on Saturday morning TV though. They were for kids, you know.
They're and
they
huge. Also just,
they were like, they were wearing those crazy outfits. They looked really funny.
They were like glam light.
I mean, that's like, I was a little kid, so I was into like Sean Cassidy and stuff back then.
Sure,
you know, like,
sure. Yeah.
Like just like really cheesy pop music. But I think I remember the Bay City Rollers being kind of good. Like, but I think I like them better than the Osmonds.
Oh, I was related to the Osmonds, I remember as a kid.
Well, they had that one good song.
Crazy Horses.
Crazy Horses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds totally good.
I was into them too, but like, I think, my favorite band of all those was the Jackson 5. So, I thought they were all kind of like the same type of band, though.
I remember in like first grade having an Osmonds lunchbox and these girls in sixth grade making fun of me for it.
Oh. Have you heard Crazy Horses? Have you heard this song?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's the one song I still think is good. I can't remember any of the other songs off the top of my head.
There's a couple of good ones on that record. That's when they were in the Zeppelin phase. There's some good songs, but mostly they do sound like the Jackson 5.
Jackson 5 are really good, though.
So are the Osmonds.
Okay.
Crazy Horses, for sure. Yeah, Red Cross covered that song, so that was really fun.
All right.
When Jeff and Steve were just on the, or Steven were just on the show, Jeff was saying he saw the Osmonds on TV one day and looked over at his little brother and said, "This is the ticket. Family act."
Yeah, right.
And he knew.
Hilarious.
He knew.
Hilarious.
I met Donnie because Donnie was doing Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoats here in Toronto for a long time, and I used to fill the vending machine in the backstage area, and he was super nice and would just like always kind of hang around and you know, like talk to people and stuff backstage. And I talked and I was like, "Yo, that one song you guys got, that song's heavy." And it was like, no one had ever told him that. He was very like, really? Yeah, he was like, oh, wow. Thank you. Or at least he faked it really well. If people were coming up to him all the time about that song.
It's a good song. Yeah.
He had that show with Marie, and they had Snoop Dogg on it one time.
Really? Oh, the talk show, not the variety show, right?
No, the talk show. Yeah, like a little later on. Snoop Dogg would have been really young, I think, if he was on the variety show. Toby, like, were there other places that you thought you were talking about moving, or was it always going to be DC because of the kind of connection with the Discord stuff?
Oh, actually, I wanted to move to San Francisco my whole life, and I tried to move there in like 1990. I couldn't find a job, so I came back to Olympia. But yeah, I think I was like, I wanted Bikini Kill to move to San Francisco, but then
why didn't you hit me up? I could have got you a job at the pizza place.
I don't know.
I could have got you a job.
I was just going around like to every place that was near Donna's apartment, like asking if they were hiring. I think I had experience doing coffee and nobody would hire me. But yeah, I tried for like a month. But I think Kathleen and Kathy were going to move away. And then Kathleen said she was going to move to Chicago. And then I was like, well, how about San Francisco? And she's like, yeah, I would do San Francisco. And then Kathy Wilcox like hates California for some reason. I don't understand. And so she's like, I will not move to San Francisco. So she just crossed it off the list. And I was like, I'm not going to move to Chicago. It's too fucking cold. Yeah. And so then like DC was like the next one because we were already on tour with Nation of Ulysses. And Kathleen is actually from DC or from Laurel, Maryland. Or she went to, I guess she's born in Portland, but she like went to middle school in Laurel, Maryland. And then Kathy's aunt lived there. It just, you know, we had like a lot of stuff like that. Friends there.
Wait, where's Kathy from?
She's from Vancouver, Washington, okay. But Vancouver, like her aunt lived in DC or something like that.
Like you said, you wanted to do it professionally as a touring band. Was it like Fugazi was kind of the model back then? Cause like, you know, the Melvins by this point, you guys were trying to I guess you were on the major label by this point. But it feels like at this moment, there isn't really a lane for kind of like what would be the like idealized version of a band you could be like at that point for you guys?
Well, I mean, I think it's like we lived really cheaply. So it was like, well, we could, you know, if we could just play this many shows, we could just live off of it. Like, you know, a certain amount of money, like we're just like writing down, like how much money would we need, you know, in order to make it work. Or you could just like figure like in your mind, like if we're just on tour all the time, then we won't have to even pay rent because we won't live anywhere. You know, just like that kind of young person idea. It wasn't like, oh yeah. Cause I didn't even have like the idea of like putting out a record or being able to like make money off of selling records. Like that idea didn't really come into my mind. Like that idea came later. It was more just like, oh, we'll just be on tour and then we'll just, that's will be what we do. But it just didn't seem like having a job would make any sense because then you would have to just always take off work and then you'd lose your job and then you'd come back and you'd have to find another job. Like if you want to do a band, you just have to like put it first, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, and I guess like, go on.
I'm trying to think of like what I was thinking. It wasn't very practical. It was just like, this is what we're doing. This is the number one most important thing in all of our lives or whatever. We're trying to make it that way.
For Fucked Up, it's always been trying to be like the Melvins, but that's because we're like a post Melvins band and post obviously the major label stuff. But just this idea of like, you can be a band and make a living. Like you're not going to, you know, be necessarily the richest person, but you can make a living off your art if you just handle your business in a certain way. And like, yeah, like you're saying, a lot of it revolves around putting out records and having records to sell and having like that sort of physical product.
Yeah, we weren't even thinking of that. We were just thinking of playing shows, mm-hmm. You know, like in the idea is just like, oh, like if you play at college, you can make like $500 or $1,000 or something. There's like so many colleges on the East Coast, you know, so it's like how much would it cost for us all to make our rent? Like we'd have to play a couple college shows a month. We never had food or anything, you know,
yeah,
we were always hungry.
Well, there's that part, I think, in Dance of Days where they talk about, you know, yourselves and Fugazi sitting around eating just like beans and rice in like a house that's freezing.
It was worse than that. It was like I don't know what it says in Dance of Days, but it was, I just remember this one time, like Fugazi's sound guy, Joey P, he's from Philadelphia. He's got like a really classic Philly accent. I can't do it, but you can imagine it. His other side job besides being sound guy was selling pretzels at in stadium shows and stuff. So like everyone at the Greep houses in DC, all of our freezers were always full of Joey P's pretzels that he was going to go sell. So we would like wait till everyone went to sleep and go downstairs and like steal these pretzels, you know, like that's how hungry we were. It was just like living off of like, and somebody worked in a bakery. So like there was free bread at one of the houses for toast or whatever. So you'd be like, oh, okay. Like the responsible person goes to bed at like 10. So we can go over to that person's house and then like steal their toast, you know, like it was really desperate.
What was it like, Dale, when that kind of world opens up? Like here you are trying to figure out how to make this band work in terms of like, you know, you're working at the pizza place, but then all of a sudden the world's attention turns to what you're doing. Like, you know, labels are coming to you now.
Yeah. I mean, well, even before that happened, we were able to tour and make enough money where we could quit our jobs. Mm. It happened really quick because, I mean, you know, we did a tour. We did that. The first tour that we did was in 86, summer of 86. And I mean, it was just so bad for us that we decided that we'd never do it again, you know? And then things changed, you know, I mean, it was because of what was happening in Seattle for sure. But yeah, I remember like in 89, I think we went, was the next time we actually did a tour where we didn't book it ourselves. We actually had somebody book it for us. And we did okay. We came home with money. We came home with money, and I actually had enough money to buy a guitar. So I bought my first electric guitar.
That's when you know it's going to work.
I didn't spend it on food or anything else. Just yeah. Guitar.
We had like a funny thing where we were just like, we did tour with the booking agent, and that those shows made no money and no one came. And then I was like, I can do a better job than this. And my tours actually made more money.
Oh, wow.
Like in the early days. Yeah. We had the opposite thing happen. It's funny.
Well, that's better than you don't have to pay somebody a percentage too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, kind of before the whole major label thing, like we were already able to do it. You know, things were pretty good for us. I mean, we hooked up with Boner, mm-hmm. and that was a really good label to be on because Tom is honest and still pays us, and those records are still on Boner. I don't know. Things turned out pretty good pretty quickly.
Yeah. And you guys always seem to have like a good sense for business, like in terms of like finding the right people to hook up with. Like, I'm sure there's been mistakes along the way, but you know, the people that you wind up doing stuff with are labels that are around for a long period of time. Even like the Slapham Flexi, like Slapham sure. winds up becoming a significant label.
Sure. We really wanted to be on SST.
Well, I guess it worked out that way.
Yeah, I know. It's like, well, yeah, things worked out better, I think. But we were fortunate to where we got to hook up with some pretty good people. And we're pretty loyal when we find somebody that we like. Like, we've had the same booking agent for a long time now. We've been working with Ipecac for a long time. It's good when you find good people.
Yeah, and it feels like if you can keep these people around, they're going to be around for life in this world. Yeah. Like, you know, the lifers.
Yeah, even our crew guys, you know, we really like them a lot, you know. And I don't know, we'd really... Once we find somebody we like I said, we're pretty loyal. You know, like we don't have people working for us that are like rock and roll roadie type guys. You know, they're quite the opposite. They're all real sweet.
You guys must have done tours at that time though with rock bands that did have that kind of vibe.
Oh yeah. Of course.
It feels so different. You know, when you're on a, like, I haven't done very many of those types of tours, but when you're on a tour like that, you're like, oh, this is a completely different thing than the punk thing.
Sure. But I mean, it just depends. You know, I mean, we've toured with bands that are big bands that have been complete jerks. And then like, well, last year we just did a tour with Ministry and they were great. Their whole crew were super nice. All the guys in the band were super nice. There was no like rock star attitude thing at all. And it made it that made it great. It made it, that was our first tour back from you know, being stuck at home for the pandemic for the last couple of years or whatever. So that was a really great tour to do.
That was sort of a wild tour too.
It was fun. Really fun.
Had you already moved, Toby, by the time all the madness started in sort of Seattle in terms of the signing of bands?
Yeah, we like moved away like in like 91. Like we played with Nirvana and Mudhoney at the Paramount, and then we moved away like 2 days later. Well, we just went on tour. Oh, wow. And we stayed in DC. So we didn't come back until like almost like about 93 or something. That's when some of us came back, and yeah, everything had completely changed. And we didn't, I don't know what was wrong with us, but like it took us so long to figure out what label to be on or what to put out that we'd recorded. And, you know, even when we first put something out, we didn't do a CD right away. And I was like looking through my journals and I was like, God, it's like 1994 when we finally realized that if we just put out CDs, we'll actually be making money. And because I was just like, oh, they owe us $8,000. And I was like, oh, God, like, I was just thinking like how naive we were, or kind of like anti, I don't know if it was like anti-materialistic or just like not motivated by money, but it's like, dude, like all we had to do was put out CDs. Like, why weren't we doing that right away? Like it could have been so much easier, you know?
I think a CD was looked up. Well, CDs were looked upon as being careerist. Like bands that did CDs wanted to do this for a living. And it seemed like that was antithetical to the DIY code.
I don't know. I think like we were so living outside of that world that we didn't know anyone that had CD players. Like It took Slim, who had a label, to be like, no, everyone's listening to CDs. I mean, well, my dad has one, but like, you know, would anyone who likes our music? And Slim had to like really explain it to me. Slim's the owner of Kill Rockstars. And he's like, the Cramps put out a CD in like 1988 or something like that. And I was like, okay. Like I had to kind of just yeah, I was against them, or I don't know. Like, it's just really funny. Like, why do you have to make it that hard for yourself? You know?
Yeah. That's what punk and hardcore is, throwing rules on yourself that you don't
necessarily know. It just seemed like some kind of like weird stumbling block. It's like, I really don't know what I was thinking. That was a stupid thing.
It's way more affordable for someone to buy a CD than to buy a vinyl setup to listen to this music. Well,
so totally.
Now people are getting nostalgic about CDs too, though, like they were about vinyl. Like we know vinyl's back, but people are getting, like kids are getting nostalgic about CDs like they were about tapes, you know, cassette.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, there definitely is a CD collector market. And I think if there's probably one thing that might be worse to hang around with than a record collector, it's probably a CD collector.
I mean, they get scratched so easily. I'm really bad. I'm really hard on them, and all the jewel cases just break and crumble.
I have CDs that have decomposed, like that just in the case, just, you know, all the information started flaking off them. Like they just feels like being a cassette collector. Like I always,
it is really good for musicians though, because there's such a high profit margin.
Yeah. And if people start buying them again.
Right. And they're so cheap to make now.
Yeah.
So they're really cheap. I mean, even now I'm surprised that more bands don't just make CDs. Cause I mean, well, for one, to make a record right now, I mean, there's, it's so backed up to get your vinyl pressed that it, you know, good luck. And just the expense, you know, I mean, if you can make CDs are so cheap, especially right now. It'd be really easy to do it yourself.
Bikini Kill makes them, but I don't know if anyone's buying them. I'll have to look.
It's the rarest format for our records now. Like we do 500 CDs or something.
Yeah.
You know, like just, but because I don't know if people buy them at the shows. Like I don't really see people buying them off our merch table.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Some, I mean, we have some that are really cheap, you know, and then there's some that are like special packaging deals, but mostly I think even stuff we sell at shows are like, definitely no more than $10 for a CD, you know, more like $5.
It makes you just like furious at how much we were paying for CDs in like the 90s.
Well, I remember
$30 for a Black Flag CD. Come on.
Oh, really? I remember when they first came out, it was like, I would go to like the best record store in San Francisco at the time was Tower, because you can go get CDs for $10.
Yeah. Well, in Canada, SST was an import. So everything was an import up here, right? So so that stuff was always at a premium. I bought Process of Weeding Out for $30, and it ruined Black Flag for a good 2 years for me. It took me two more years before I could finally, you know, get over the fact that I felt like I had been ripped off by paying $30 for this instrumental record.
I like that record.
Yeah. I like it now. I like it now. But at the time, I was not ready for it, you know?
I wasn't ready for it when it came out either. I like it now, though.
And I think now that I started smoking weed, I love it. Like, whew, now it makes sense.
Yeah, it could make sense.
It's because Greg Ginn's a deadhead. That's why.
Yes, exactly. Did you hear Steve's story about going to the show and talking to Greg afterwards and not thinking that Greg recognized him?
That's what he told me. He's like, yeah, I don't think he knew who I was.
That was funny. That's my goal, to smoke that much weed that I forget huge chunks of my life. That's really where I want to be one day. And I'm not even joking. That's actually my goal. So this has been phenomenal to get to do this with you both. And anytime you both want to come back in any configuration or together, please know you're always welcome, because I can't think of two more influential drummers in punk rock. Like, there's obviously other influential drummers, but like, just very different styles and just very informative and inspirational to kids, you know, like Melvins and Bikini.
Oh, thanks.
Like, how many bands have you inspired? Like, I watched a video, Toby.
Two.
And two right here. But I watched a video the other day of Bikini Kill in Australia, and you're at the show, and the singer of the Distillers' old band's playing. Like, it's wild, the ripples that kind of came out of the stones you threw into the world.
Yeah, everyone, like, writes those comments on that video, too, of, like, that we're, like, you know, not being polite or something while they're playing. But like, this is what I remember, is like, it, like, we had to play a show that day, and they're like, oh, we're gonna take you girls to the rock and roll high school or something like that in Australia, and then there's gonna be a concert for you. But I just remember being like, we hadn't really had coffee yet, and then we walk into this room that's like all kids, and there's really bright lights, and they just are performing for us.
That's a nightmare. That is the nightmare of being on tour.
And then you notice that they're filming you too. Like, your reaction. So I'm just sitting there going, like, I'm like wearing sunglasses or something, and I'm like, oh my God, this is so awkward.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you know, I did meet Brody on that tour, and you know, she's very talented. Even then, she was, you know, she kind of sounded like Courtney Love at that time. Her band was a very Hole influence, but I mean, you know, she's nice. I think she was like 16 or something.
Yeah. It's just wild. Like, you know, the people that are in these shows, these tiny spaces, that wind up doing music because of the direct influence of you two.
Well, I mean, Dale is a big influence on me. Like, even though I don't play like Dale style drums, like, I do remember the one thing, like, when I first started playing, I was like, well, you got to hit the drums really hard. And I was just like, hit the drums really hard, no matter what style of music it was, so much that the drums would just fall over because they were just, you know, not tightened properly or something. So yeah, Dale, you definitely inspired me to practice all the time and hit the drums hard, you know? So that's definitely a part of that influence.
You keep doing it. Maybe we'll get star. We'll get our own Hollywood star. Actually, I saw. So I live now in the Coachella Valley, which is basically near Palm Springs. And you know Hal Blaine, right? You guys know who Hal Blaine is, right? Everybody knows who Hal Blaine is.
Yeah,
they should.
What is that?
You've heard him.
Wrecking Crew, right? Yeah.
The Wrecking Crew, right? The Monkees, the Beach Boys, Elvis. Anyway, he got his own star dedicated to him in Palm Springs, and I was at the dedication the other day.
Oh, wow.
And Clem Burke was there.
Oh, wow.
And I know Clem a little bit, and I was talking to him, and what I didn't realize is, like, oh yeah, we're gonna have a little jam down the street where we play some Wrecking Crew songs.
Whoa.
Like, oh cool. And I went and watched him play, and I was just at this little restaurant or whatever, and I see Clem kind of walks by me and says hello to this woman who's sitting right behind me. And I look and I'm like, that's fucking Nancy Sinatra. Nancy Sinatra was sitting right behind me. I'm like, oh my God, I couldn't believe it. And then I'm thinking, these guys are going to play. She's going to sing.
Wow.
Come on. She's got to sing. And so like, you know, sure enough, they do Boots, and I don't think she was planning on it. But then, one of the guys who was involved in Hal Blaine getting his star, was his nephew, and he came over with a microphone and handed it to her. And so she was like, basically like seeing Boots right in front of me. It was awesome.
That's amazing. So,
but that was pretty incredible. I'm like, all right, I hung out in Palm Springs with a Sinatra.
Yeah. driving by their house was one of the highlights when I went out to Coachella Valley, the old Frank Sinatra house. So.
Oh, yeah. I went there not that long ago to try to take a look at it. And it was kind of, it was opened, and me and some other friends kind of snuck up there to look in, and we were shooed away, but they were polite about it.
Like, both of you are first stars on the Turned Out of Punk Hall Walk of Fame. As soon as I
build
it, maybe I'll put it in the basement, put some little stars in here, but both of you are first ballot entries in that thing for sure.
Excellent.
Cool. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.